Welcome everybody to Midweek Mysticism, Winter Edition. It is great to see you all. In the mat, which will screen share, we are on page 134, 135. Someone remind me, where did we leave off?
135 at the
135.
paragraph break.
Five expanses are written here. Great. Now, we are doing secret mystical interpretation of the verse. Yeah. Yihi Rakia. Let there be an expanse. And so now we're gonna, we've done a little bit of an introduction about that last time, and now we're gonna move on a bit. Okay. Five expanses are written here. People say, oh, am I screen sharing? Okay. Or no?
Let's see a screen share, Rabbi.
All right, share. I will share the screen. Voila. Five expanses are written here. People see that? So
Yes.
the word rakia in the verses related to the second day appears five times. And as I think I mentioned last time, but maybe I didn't, the way in biblical grammar that things are emphasized is not always with language of emphasis, but with the stylized form of biblical Hebrew. So, for example, the sound of chol or lach repeats a certain number of key times. And so the style of biblical Hebrew often, rather than in English, we would say, you know, this thing is very important, but we're dealing with a kind of biblical poetry of sorts. And one of the ways in which meaning is emphasized is through the structure of it. You know, a lot has been written about the use of chiastic structures like the Greek letter chi, but also a significant number of times a word appears within a paragraph within the Torah. And for those that read the Torah, you know it's divided into parshiot where there are paragraphs. And so if a key word appears five or seven or 10 or 13 times in a particular paragraph, that is presumed to indicate something about the word itself. And so that method of interpretation is one used by academics and mystics alike. In other words, this is a very classic and natural way to do biblical interpretation. It's not just a mystical way to do biblical interpretation. It's actually the plainest way to do biblical interpretation. One of the things you do if you are a student of modern Israeli Tanakh study, according to most of the schools, is you wind up counting words. You know, I have my Tanakh, and every time I think there's a key word, what do? I count. How many times does this word appear in this paragraph? That's what advanced Tanakh teachers do, but you don't need to be a rocket scientist to count, though we do have one rocket scientist on the call, but at least. So here are five expanses are written. Rakia appears five times. So the Zohar is going to say that it is not just significant to emphasize, but these five rakiot or expanses describe the five sfirot. Which sfirot exactly? Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferach, Netzach, and Hod. Or if you're in the, where's the sfirot chart? Open up. Hold on. My control panel where I can stop. Right, so the five Rikiot are specific Sfirot: Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, Netzach, and Hod. And of course, that makes sense because we're on the second day, so we're already kind of progressing. We are beginning on the third day. We're already gonna try and deal with the synthesis of the conflict between Chesed and Gevurah. We've talked already about the second day being a day that was not good, and so there's already a conflict between Chesed and Gevurah. But the seeds of, or the expanses of the Sfirot are also sown. There's a sense in which things are created, recreated, partially created, but all of their creation is latent even in earlier times. And so even though other Sfirot will become more clearly manifest, but the five Rikiot already represent these five core Sfirot. So let's see what they say about them. I'm going to read the paragraph and then we'll go back. Five expanses are written here. Vitality of the worlds moves through them, conducts by them, all comprising one another. Were it not for this conflict, harmonized by the middle, they would not merge or be at peace with one another. There are 500 years to which the tree of life clings, generating verdure and offspring for the world. All the waters of creation drawn and flowing from the beginning branch beneath it, beginning branch beneath it, through it. King David captures it all and then distributes, as is written. He distributed among all the people, the entire multitude of Israel, a cake made in a pan and a raisin cake. Similarly, you give to them, they gather, and she rises while it is still night and gives food to her household. Where was I recently where this verse about the raisin cake and the cake was quoted? I was somewhere else recently, other than this year, where someone quoted this verse, like in the last 3 days. Was anyone else in that thing? In some totally other context. Okay. Or it was deja vu. So, well, I think it happened. What's going on here? What is going on? So let's discuss that. Vitality of the worlds moves through them. In Hebrew, Chei Almin. Chei Almin is in the Kabbalah also the term Hey Ha'olamim, which appears in our liturgy. Hey Ha'olamim, as opposed to Ha'olamim. Now, in some of the other ancient manuscripts, it's actually Ha'olamim, so I don't want to get too much into the grammar. But Hey or Ha'olamim or Ha'olamim means the life giver of the world. Hey means like it's the hif'il, if you're a grammarian of Chai, to live. Hey is an Hif'il, but the hif'il here is a seireh because of the way that Chai is. Anyway, what is God is described as the life giver of the worlds. And the life giver of the worlds in Kabbalah always refers to one and one thing only, the sphera of Yesod. You want to jump to the chart for a moment. Yesod is the life giver of the worlds because Yesod is the thing that it mediates between the upper and lower world. It collects the, on the one hand, it collects the divine energy and impulses of the spiritual realms above, and kind of like a laser, collects all of that, and it winds up becoming the medium. We used water in a previous example in a pool for bringing all of God's energy down into Shekhinah, into the earthly realm or the godly realms that are earthly. And Yesod also serves as the place to which human tefillot are directed and impulses of spiritual energy in our world wind up filtering back up theurgically and affecting God. And so Yesod is the meeting place between God and life, as it were. And so it's both the life giver of the worlds, but it's the life giver of all the worlds, because it's not just the life giver of the worlds in a down, in a top down manner, but it's also in a bottom up manner, which you don't quite see in the vertical nature of the chart. The Kabbalists imagine that every time the word Baruch is said, that Yesod is intended. They associate the Sfira of Yesod with Joseph and with sexual purity. The reason they associate it, of course, with sexual purity is because it's the thing that leads to creation. And so if you're going to create, they want to make sure that the creation is done in covenant and all of that. And so that.
And also perhaps because of its association with Joseph.
Right, because Joseph is the one that resists the wife of Potiphar. And so here's a person who, on the one hand, is able he's able to be sexually pure. And the other, he's able to literally create food amidst famine. It's as close to yesh mayayin, something from nothing. Joseph is an extremely creative figure with his dreams also and his imaginations. So it's not just sexual creation for Joseph, but it's an entirety of an extremely creative and original kind of person. So here we have Yesod. Okay, so back to the Zohar now, right? So vitality of the worlds moves through them, conducts by them, all comprising one another. So here we're describing a way in which, when you have these five expanses, actually Yesod, which is generated by human energy below, is the thing that pulses through these other. It moves upward. You follow if we're looking at our chart. And so spiritual energy from below, which it's kind of funny because humans haven't been created yet. We're on day two. Yeah. So like, what are we even talking about? Right. But here we're really only talking about the potential of the existence of life is the thing that generates the energy that causes life itself. It is a kind of postmodern take. You could even say our own perspective on this generates its own existence, right? That they go nearly that far. And so energy from below, in any event, pulses through all of these spherot. But in doing that, all comprising one another, there's a sense in which emanation is emphasized. What is emanation? That this is not some transformation from one sphere out to the next, but in some fundamental way, even though we're talking about different qualities or dressings or lights or manifestations or expanses or water or whatever language or sounds or whatever language you want to use, but it's actually the same. Everything after reflects exactly everything before, all compressing one another. Every sphere has every other sphere out in it. That's what makes creative energy is when things are interacting. When things are isolated, so then there is, what we saw before, there's hell and there's conflict. But when we have creative energy, everything isn't just interacting, everything actually embodies the things and everything else. And so there's almost what I like to call Kabbalistic empathy here. Every sphera has the actual things of the other spherot in it. You could see the biggest ritual manifestation of this when you count the spherot. And they have that like 49 system tikkun or mystical fix that you can do after, where you can list, chesed shel chesed, bur shel chesed, and they make popular charts and tell you it symbolizes your right pinky toe or that today is a good day to be kind to a stranger or all kinds of practical things. But fundamentally, it's a system where every sira comprises the parts of every other sira because that's what it means to emanate. God isn't changing. God is filtering. Now, were it not for this conflict harmonized by the middle, because here we have multiple sides, chesed and gevurah, loving kindness and strictness or strength. And then on the other hand, we have another duality or dyad, which is netzach. Netzach is long, eternity, victory. So it is a kind of longer, you can think of it as long term, and hod, which is short term, splendor in this moment. Long and short is, I think, a good way to think about it. But some people also prefer the kind of rubric of being versus doing, because if you're thinking a long game, you're trying to fix or transform. Whereas if anyway, I've said enough about that. I think that's the Kabbalistic version of men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or probably a lot of political disputes relate to like how much do you want to live in a future versus how much is it about now. So all the wonders of creation. Oh, so okay, there are five. That's where we are. Now we're going to go with a new kind of metaphor for these expanses. These five expanses are actually a 500-year-old tree. But the tree isn't just 500 years old. It clings to these years. So now, this is like a good time to take your psychedelic. The Zohar is offering you an image of what you imagine they're going through a spiritual experience and imagine these expanses and transforming themselves through the poetry of chanting or studying this passage. There are 500 years to which the tree of life clings, generating verdure and offspring for the world. So this tree of life, these five sphirot, are like 500 years of a tree, a big, beautiful, old tree. You know, there's something very compelling. The tree of life. And we imagine this is the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. But the tree of life isn't just a tree that happens to be in the world. The tree of life is like the source of energy that generates the world. And the years are the essence of existence of this tree. And it generates, because it's a tree, like begets like, this tree creates, is able to create other things. Like God is like a tree because the world is filled with vegetation. And so God must, if emanation is it's not, here's a way of saying it. I received this this idea from Melila, also who I love, which is, if the Sfirot fundamentally aren't changes but just emanations of each other, but they all contain each other and all comprising one another. Then this world should be in some way, but some Elohim in the image of not just people, but the whole world has to be in some way in the image of God. And so, in some way, God is like, the world. And so, God is like a tree to the extent the world is filled with plants. And so, generating verdure and offspring, right? The thing about a tree is the tree generates new trees. Trees love to do that. And then I uproot them because they're destroying my fence, right? So, that's what trees do. They make other mini trees. All the waters of creation, now we're at, we're mixing our metaphors literally here because we've used water before. All the waters of creation drawn and flowing from the beginning, because we've described the energy of the Sefirot as Mayim, right? Ruach Elohim merachet et al pnei mayim, the Spirit of God was hovering above the water. So all the waters of creation drawn and flowing from the beginning of divine time. Branch beneath it, through it. It's the xylem and phloem. This is the liquid that the roots of the tree absorb. The tree absorbs the energy of the spherotes that course through it and mix through it. And then King David, so when I know when I read this, it's because I'm reading Tanakh to my daughter at night, and we're up to Shmuel. Okay, that's where I read this to my sick daughter. So the thanks, I remember now. It's not deja vu. So when does King David, what's the situation where King David starts to give gifts to everyone? Anyone know? I wouldn't happen to know, but I'll tell you because now I know. It's when the ark is returned to Jerusalem from capture of the Philistines, and they offer korbanot, they offer sacrifices, and have a celebration for the return of the Aron, of the Ark of the Covenant. And at that moment, King David sings a song, Hodu Lashem, etc., which is the introductory section of Psukei deZimra. The first couple of paragraphs of Psukei deZimra are an exact quote of the song King David sings there. Now, King David doesn't actually sing the song in that portion of Tanakh, mind you. He commissions a particular person whose name I forget to write a song for him, leading me to wonder how many was King David just like Taylor Swift? Does he write his own songs or is he commissioning people to write songs? How is this going? Because how come here? I thought he was the musician, but then why is he commissioning someone I never heard of in Tanakh, whose name I check only is mentioned once to commission his song? Anyway, separate point. So Just trying to keep it real. So King David then commissions a song, and he distributed it among all the people, the entire multitude. He gives gifts to everyone at the celebration. You could kind of think of it like Mardi Gras, where there's a party with a gift-giving culture to it, where things are given out. A cake made in a pan and a raisin cake. I say he starts giving everyone cake, like Marie Antoinette, but before Marie Antoinette. And I know that cake was just bread. So here's my so what does that mean? So that becomes now mystically significant. When the Ark of the Covenant enters, is another language, and that's what they're alluding to here. You know, when the Ark of the Covenant enters the camp of Israel, that's a way of saying that things are no longer isolated but in proper flow. And all of a sudden that flow is able to come all the way down into the world, into Shekhinah. David represents Shekhinah as kind of messianic energy, and he gives gifts to the people. It's Yesod is open with flow, and Shekhinah is in a giving kind of mood. And so this is what creates the possibility of creation itself, or life, right? The possibility of continuous creation is life. Similarly, it also says in Psalms, you give to them, they gather. And from Proverbs, and people know this one because it's sung on Kabbalah on Friday night in many households. Vatakom be'od laila. Anyone finish that verse? Know if anyone's singing Eshet Chayil. I don't actually remember the end of the verse, but she rises while the someone will remember it. She rises while it's still night and gives food to her household. Who is she? It's talking about the woman of the valor. But here we imagine, and this is what people say, you know, this is not about the woman, it's about the Shekhinah or the Shabbat queen, which is true. Here you see a Zoharic use of Proverbs 31, referring to the woman of valor as the Shekhinah. The woman of valor because she's productive in that chapter of Proverbs. She gives food and she makes clothes. And this is about God giving, about creation, about divine energy flowing into the material world. That's what the woman of valor does in that paragraph. So she rises while it is still night and gives food to her household. What's the significance of while it is still night? In the plain meaning, the exoteric meaning, she rises while it's still night is she's extremely hardworking. She gets up early to start the day's work. She's an early riser, a morning person. 4 a.m., she's up doing things. You know, I received an email from someone at 5 a.m. today, and I thought, wow, that person, they must work too hard. But in other words, they work very hard. And so, and I felt bad for them. So the Shekhinah, that's the exoteric meaning. The mystical meaning of she rises while still night, though, is even in an unredeemed world, you know, she's rising in order to bring the divine energy, which would represent a kind of messianic energy, a descendant of King David, and gives food to her household and provides, you know, things to humans living in the abyss of divinity, but reaching out for connection. So, just to summarize where we are here in this paragraph, these five expanses in the second day represent the five sefirot from Chesed to Hod. And these five sefirot can also be thought of as 500 years through which the tree of life absorbs the water of these sefirot and produces or becomes the source of the energy of all creation of the world. And so it's the same way there's water and xylem and phloem. There's this kind of dynamic, creative energy that's at play, which is also represented in verses about King David or the Shekhinah providing material well-being. You know, there's the sense of divinity giving or overflowing. You know, the emanation theory is all about the overflow of divine energy and excess in order to create. And that's, you know, what the Neo, that's what Plotinus wrote about. And if you're into like Neoplatonic thinking, you can see heavy Neoplatonic influence in this, where overflow energy, the trees, you know, pulsing with liquid is what causes new energy. Or King David giving cake to people upon being blessed with the return of the ark. Or the Shekhinah giving food to her household. the Sefirot overflowing with divine energy to produce things beyond. Imagine them as cups that continually overflow in a river of divine energy. Okay. Now we get to some new characters. Colonel Ember is my favorite. Yeah, Peter, so first we'll open for comment and before we get to Colonel Ember. Comments, thoughts, questions, anything, musings?
I don't know if it's a comment on myself or a question for you, but it's very vivid, but it's also really confusing. And I'm confusing about the count and confused about the count in particular, because at one moment we're focusing on these five spherot and saying it's like the 500 years, but we almost instantaneously bring in Yesod and then Malchut. So is it five or is it six or is it seven? And Bina was not many lines above. So it's five or six or seven or eight.
Good. So Art Green once explained this like this. Wait a second. Sometimes the Zohar is trying to speak. We're on day two. We're trying to speak about the first two sphero. And now we've already got all seven. What's with the Zoharic confusion? He once asked in a lecture I attended. And he said, here's the thing. In passages where the Zohar is trying to explain the overflow of the spheriotic energy, it sometimes gets caught and can't contain itself. And just like it imagines divine energy inevitably overflowing because it can't help or can't be contained, sometimes the Zohar can't contain his energy to organization. But that's not a cop-out, you follow. In other words, here's a passage about how do we get this kind of divine overflow. And so you're actually going to get, each time they expand to a new metaphor, a little more overflow or mission creep to like future days we haven't described yet, because those future days are already here, because the world, vitality of the world moves through them, conducts by them, all comprising one another. They all are part of each other. And so once you get the overflow, it's a domino. So that, I think the Zohar is trying to capture in its own style the energy it's trying to describe, which can't really be contained, if that makes sense. It's ecstatic in this shorter way of saying it.
Okay, thank you.
That's, I think, the best way of understanding it.
No, that's good.
Anyone else? Prepare. Now, this is the last teaching. Part of this sentence. After this, we'll move on to the next verse. When conflict was aroused, so I'll read as I do, I'll read the whole teaching and then we'll go back. When conflict was aroused by the potency of the left, Colonel Ember, or Pila de Tifsa, glowed and let me turn the page. Out came two specters, male and female, immediately congealing with no moisture at all. From them split all various maleficent species. From here, infusion of impure spirit into all those fierce specters, mystery of foreskin. They were empowered by virulent species, viper and serpent, turning into one. The viper bears 70 years, but in union all reverse to the 7 years of the serpent. Here lies the mystery of hell, called by seven names. The evil impulse is called by seven names. From here, through countless rungs, impurity spreads to the world, all from the mystery of the left. Good and evil diverge, cultivation of the world. Here is engraved the name of 18 letters, presiding over reign of favor and blessing, cultivating the world. You should be asking, huh? Just drop 19 cryptic things in a row and call it a teaching? But don't worry. If you're like, what was that? That's where you're supposed to be. and we're going to decipher it together. That's what we do. And then at the end, we'll try and read it again after we know what it means, to see if it makes sense. Think of this like, if you've ever played piano, we're going to play a really complicated song, and so you're going to go through each little phrase, like finger by finger, to figure out how to make it work. Then it's going to take a few re-readings to put it all together to sound anything like music, you know? But if you do it that way, you'll get there, and then in the end, you get something quite beautiful. So here beautifully hellish is where we'll end try to end. But we're going to turn dark now. We just had this beautiful ecstatic moment of divine energy, the tree of life pulsing energy into the world. But in the Zohar, you never go too far before you immediately go to the dangerous demons in hell. Right? They always lurk. So let's just describe. Okay. When conflict was aroused by the potency of the left, because you remember, we're now past Peter's, we've been on a tangent. Day two was not good. And so day two is the day where what happens? Hell is created. Because the left side decided to be terrorists on day two. That's what happened. The left side decided to attack and not to be willing to compromise and to just be in it for total victory at any cost. Doom and destruction. The left side are terrorists in the Zohar language. So
can I ask a quick question about that? What the left of what?
The left of what? Left-handed people like me. No, so so the left here, we really just mean Gevura.
I wasn't sure if you meant the Sefirot or something else. Okay.
All yeah, right. So when we mean the left here, you know, Chesed is day one, let's say, so Gevura is day two. So the left is judgment, is red. Is strength, is machloket, is fighting, and so that's what they mean by the left. It also does have a feminine aspect to it, and we could talk about why, you know, negativity and demonics are associated with female energy in the Zohar. There's what to say about that, but I'm not going to say it though. So now. We could talk about a different time, unless anyone wants to. So that's what we mean by left. Does that kind of help a little?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Okay, now who is this Colonel Ember? I got to start here. So what the way that the left, not the political left, the Zoharic left, decides to... it's funny if you... Ostensibly, I'm not saying really, but ostensibly, modern political parties are kind of the opposite. Like, the right is more the left, and the left is more the right in American politics. Anyway, so
is that so? I mean, the left wants to expand government power and give to the people that way, and the right constrains it.
That could be, although you could say that the left. It's not my point, but I guess what I had in mind is that the left imagines itself as charitable, whereas the right imagines itself as harsh realists.
Right, and what the right does is it restrains the charitability of the left to prevent it from becoming running wild.
I'm going to ignore it. I hear what you're saying. I'm going to table our little maybe. So how does this happen? There is a particular person involve Orfila de Tipsa. Here, the Matt note 219 is helpful. Colonel Ember in this fantastic translation. Orfila derives from the Aramaic Rufila, which is the Latin Rufulus, a military tribune appointed by the general. Tipsa means ember. So it's like General Ember, or they've gone here. Here, the demonic Colonel Ember is empowered and inflamed by the harsh conflict. Now, so you see, when the left did this, Colonel Ember glowed and flared. So, right, in other words, here they imagine that conflict is fiery, right? You see on our Sphero chart, Gevura is associated with fire, one of the elements, but here you see it, anger and destruction are associated with fire. And Colonel Ember is like empowered, that's right, by this, you know, he's like excited by this conflict. And so he...
Can I just ask, the conflict is still, we're still the conflict between the division of the Rakia, so this is still the fundamental conflict of day two?
Yeah, here they're really talking about Chesed and Gevura again, the distinction between loving kindness or outward giving and Gevura, inwardness or strict judgment or, you know, you don't deserve my kindness or that kind of thing. So Yeah. So out came two specters. Where are these specters coming out from exactly? I think there's a fire, if you imagine here, from Colonel Ember, and out of the fire produced by Colonel Ember up here. So they're kind of like, it's almost like jeweler image, you know, or some kind of molten craftsperson image. Out of the fire, two specters, male and female, immediately congealing with no moisture at all. Who are the two specters, male and female? These are the male demons and the female demons. Now, you see, the male demons and the female demons, you have to understand, the howl and the demons and whatnot, it starts on the Gevurah side. But there are demons, as Nathaniel Berman points out at Brown University, on every end of the Zohar. Wherever any sphera becomes detached from interaction with the others, namely at its own excess points, demons emerge. And so here you get male and female demons, top and bottom, left and right. They join forces. So you have here not just creation of dark energy or the Sitra Achra, but actually, you know, they join together, so they become stronger. And notably, this happens with no moisture at all. Now, why is it with no moisture? Yehi rakia b'toch hamayim. Let there be, so here we're interpreting, let there be an expanse amidst the waters. Well, actually, what happens in that expanse between water and water? We imagine water and an expanse in the middle. So in that middle dry thing is actually where the demons from the various sides are able to congeal together. And so so wait, what is it? I thought you told me a minute ago that the expanse were really five expanses and that every one of these expanses wasn't a breeding ground for demon babies, but rather it was this beautiful 500 years of the tree of life and pools of divine energy. And but here it's, you know, demons at a meetup. So what's going on? The answer is both. Anytime there's creation, and anytime divine energy, you know, kind of flows there with it as it moves away from God or filters, there's the increased possibility of that which is evil or demonic at every level. From them split off various maleficent species. So this is parallel to the verdure and the offspring of the tree of life. You should read this as a parallel passage. Just like the divine energy produces offspring, the demons produce offspring, maleficent species. From here, infusion of impure spirit into all those fierce specters. Mystery of foreskin. Okay. So they imagine, and we got this a little bit in the introduction to the Zohar when they talked about the circumcision ceremony. They imagine that the foreskin represents the demonic excess present. Because where is foreskin? On a male, it's on a penis. And that's the creative, you know, that's the organ where the semen comes from. So they imagine that's the place where creative energy is flowing. It's like the equivalent of Yesod. And so wherever there's creative energy, there's wherever there's sex, there's temptation and sin. Wherever there's creative energy, there are demons. And so for the Zohar, it's not just that sexual sin is particularly bad. It's not just for the Zohar. I'd say for a whole society, that's like the great taboo or thing or whatever, right? But that's the thing that is inherently going to be fraught. Wherever the moment of creative possibility is present, there's also the possibility of demons and impure spirits. And so the foreskin, you know, you can ask a basic question, which the Greeks asked, and the Zohar is mindful of here, right? The Greek critique of circumcision was, if the human body is perfect, why would you need to amend surgically the human body in an operation? And so here, the Zohar's answer to the critique of the Greeks would be, no, the foreskin represents the human action necessary to fight against or remove demonic impulses, right? They also probably imagine that circumcision is actually lessening sexual pleasure, and therefore there is a kind of thing here where they imagine it's lessening sexual sin or temptation to sexual sin. In other words, it represents the human need in whenever new things are being done to fight against the demonic powers which attack at those moments. That could be represented sexually. It could also be represented as human ego or arrogance. If you wanted to read this as a proto-AI teaching, you could think about, you know, human arrogance at moments of great creativity and the potential for destruction or danger and hubris, but it is plainly sexual here. Now, they were empowered by virulent species. So actually, do you see how we're doing okay? We're most of the way through this, and it actually does make sense, believe it or not. So we're getting there. We keep going line by line. They were empowered by virulent species, the viper and serpent. The viper bears 7 years, but in union all refers to the 7 years of the serpent. Huh? So this is, if you can see. There is a Midrashic tradition, and the Zohar loves to draw on the Midrashic tradition. It is a form of Midrash also. It's a mystical Midrash. So there is this idea in the Midrash that a viper bears or gives birth at 70 years and a serpent at 7. Now, why are 70 and 7 significant? So do you see how they're literally quoting the Midrash in the Zohar? Right, so the Zohar is quoting without, we would call this plagiarism. The Zohar is quoting the Midrash. The viper bears its 7 years, but in union, all reverse to the 7 years of the serpent. Matt tells us the gestation period of snakes is actually several months. But what we mean here is that all of the spherot, or all 7 of the spherot, produce the possibility of demonic, right? But all reverse to the 7 years of the serpent. There's a sense at which, just like all is one in the Zohar, and all results in one, here the 70 is reducible to its division of 10. All things ultimately reduce to a kind of proto-demonic energy in Gevurah on day 2. And so all of the demon energy is offspring of. That's what they mean by, they're summarizing. The viper bears its 7 years, but in union all reverse to the 7 years of the serpent is the demonic version of the Zohar two-step. Just like God's emanation is ultimately all from one, so to the demonic emanation is also from a simpler and root source. Here lies the mystery of that, which is associated with vipers and serpents. And of course, in the story of the tree of life, if we're trying to parallel the tree of life as a symbol of God's energy, then the serpent is a symbol of the demonic energy. I cite for you Lori Hope Lefkowitz's work here. If you don't know Lori Hope Lefkowitz, a teacher at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, who in her book, I think credibly claims in her Freudian reading of the Genesis story, that which feels appropriate to cite, that you should imagine the, prepare to have your minds blown, imagine that the serpent there represents Adam's disembodied sexuality, that is a man's propensity to engage in sexual sin without thinking, and it represents a phallus, but it's not connected to Adam because it represents the mind of its own that a man can take in a demonic and dangerous mode. And the fruit, of course, represents what fruit always represents. It represents sexual temptation. And so the whole story is a kind of interesting dialogue between Adam, who denies or is plainly in denial about his own sexual, or in shame about his own sexual and sinful desires, which could lead to kind of dangerous creation. And Eve, who also feigns a sort of innocence in the story, all of which is out of shame, that ultimately is the result of the thing they create. They kind of create their own shame at the end by realizing they're naked and needing to be clothed. And so it's a story about shame and sex, the way Lori Hope Lefkowitz reads that, and creation. So here we have something similar. Here lies the mystery of hell, called by seven names. There is a rabbinic tradition, and it's a Gemara, a Talmud, and Erevin, that there are seven hells, just like there are seven heavens. Yeah, there are also seven hells. This is probably an earlier, the little research on this is probably comes from the Hechalot schools, and there they give the names of the hell, Sheol, Aber Shachat, etc. There are several. You could see the Gemara there if you want to see it. So the evil impulse, the Yetzer Hara, is also called by seven names, which is another Talmud in Sukkah. Right, so they're now mixing Midrash, Talmud, and equating them all. You know, the 7 years of the serpent's gestation is the same as the seven layers of hell, is the same as the seven names for the evil impulse, the Yetzer Hara. From here, through countless rungs, impurity spreads through the world. Countless rungs are the infinite divine worlds of the demonic sphere, the kind of alter ego of the sphere. All from the mystery of the left. Good and evil diverge, cultivation of the world. So it is actually this evil and this demonic shadow world and the world of the Sefirot that we described in the prior teaching of the five Rakiyo being the various spirit, is this world, this dark world and that good world. What is it? Is the world good or is the world evil? Are people good or are they evil? Is life meaningful or totally meaningless? What is going on here? The answer is, it is that tension, says the Zohar, which cultivates our world. It's both. The world is beautiful and terrible. It is beautiful and horrible. And that is life. Here is the engraved name of 18 letters presiding over reign of favor and blessing, cultivating the world. So the name of 18 letters, we don't know exactly what the name of 18 letters is, but the classic commentaries assume it is what Matt says in his note 226. So look, there of the Yud Hey Vav Hey, there are only three letters because Hey repeats. So if you want to find out all the ways to permute Yud Hey Vav Hey, you get Yud Hey Vav and Hey Vav Yud and Hey Yud Vav Yud, etc. And that's 18. And of course, 18 represents life, like the tree of life. And so if you take the divine name and mix it around, almost like a magic spell, that is the building block of the code of the tree of life or the source of life itself. And so why are we there? Presiding over reign of favor and blessing, cultivating the world. Because reign is something that, as they mentioned here, livracha v'lo l'klala, rain can be for blessing or curse. You can have too much rain. You can have flood rain. You can have absence of rain. You can have drought. Rain can be an instrument of punishment or hell, but rain can be the source of life and blessing. And so God can be an instrument of punishment and hell as emanated through Gevurah and ultimately through his demonic children who are empowered and merged, overseen by the great demon, well, Lilith, as we've seen earlier, but on Samael, but also Colonel Ember, the kind of general of the army in this metaphor of flaming demons. Who preside over the various layers of hell, which exactly shadow or mirror the world of light. But by permuting the letters of God's name correctly, we can take part in this kind of way to use all of the energy to produce even the sources of deen as a source of good. Even rain, which can be a source of judgment, can be a source of blessing. This in the Lurianic Kabbalah is called Hamtakata Din, sweetening of the judgment. Luria imagines that the goal is not to eliminate judgment, people want to like be non-judgmental. So Loriana Kabbalah generally thinks that non-judgmentalism is fake because the world is filled with judgment. The root of the world exists in the tension between judgment and non-judgment, but rather that one can sweeten judgment by judging favorably or charitably, but one first has to judge critically before one can then judge favorably. Say, hey, that person's a jerk. Actually, maybe they're having a tough day and that's why they cut me off. In other words, that's a simplified version of it, but that's what the Zohar imagines here, is that you actually need that negativity in order to produce the possibility of sin, which is the possibility of a world where we might have any role. So that is the end of day two. The role of the creation of evil and hell and demons in our life. Next time, I'll open up a little discussion about whether this resonates or not, because we're out of time, but I it's a lot. We'll give a minute for any comment.
Yeah. The existence of demons and of evil is a necessary part of the fact that there are created things in the world. Nothing would have been created.
So that's what the Zohar is saying. It's not just that, but understand that that evil has the same demonic beauty. There's a dark beauty to it. The Zohar is engaging its best witchcraft here. There's like a great beauty, and it wants to play up the demonic as much as the ecstasy of the divine light. You know, it's going to go in both directions here. So I'd leave you on that dark note. I don't know.
Just a quick question. The 70 years and the 7 years, can you, I'm figuring 7 years was Shemitah, but what was the 70 years?
No. So 70 and seven represents the Sefirot multiplied. So what they mean to say is that the early kernels of Gevura seed ultimately demonic possibilities in all of the Sefirot. In other words, it has offspring. Multiplication is a way to show offspring in the Zohar. So whenever you multiply 7 by 10, what you mean to say is it starts with like kernel ember, but ultimately you get, you know, all of the manifestations or the growth of the demonic as they produce offspring, as they're empowered by Gevura. But human action is the thing that empowers them, just to be clear. When we sin or fight or do things like this, we are the ones that empower demons to run the world, or the opposite. And on that note, I wish everyone a happy Wednesday. We'll keep coming back. This is, I think I promised in the plugging of this class, like we're going to get to demons. There's going to be a little more of this. So this is the creation of the demon worlds. That's what we're doing. That's day two. What was created on day two? Machloket. Hell, you thought it was, you know, Yehirakiya, but no, Machloket, hell, and demons are the things that were created on day two. They don't teach you that in school. They teach you day one was light and day two is whatever, but what they really should teach you are demons, fiery demons. Good day.
Well, everyone, even in school, they notice that God does not say that it's good what he created on the second day.
Right. All of this stems from the exoteric fact that the second day is not described as good. Which is to say, not everything God creates is good. This is the day where God created all the bad things.
Well, okay. It's not all good, but it was all on purpose, right? Isn't that, that's kind of the overarching point here?
Beautiful, on purpose, ecstatic, mystical, interesting. Not good.
Gosh.